Shabbat Shalom. And we are going to be starting today. Is it set yet? Okay. We are going to be starting today on a series I've been looking to do for a long time. I did this probably around almost 15 years ago. And we took it down off the website. I wanted to redo it, and I thought this would be a great time to redo it now at the school on the early congregation. Yahweh willing, I'm hoping to get this book written on this the beginning of next year. And it's extremely important. It's important for a lot of different ways to understand, because I said before, probably 90%, 95% of believers come out of some kind of Christian background. And I don't think most people realize how much that background affects them. You know, that if you came and you became a believer and you were a Muslim or you were a Hindu or you were a Jew, you'd have a whole different perspective. But coming as a Christian, you know, we somehow don't realize all of the Christian baggage beside Sunday keeping and Christmas and Easter and all the things, false grace that most people still take with them. And I think by understanding the early congregation and really seeing why there had to be an early congregation, how it started, what it came from, and then looking at the congregation through the wilderness, looking at when Christianity started. Some people think that Christianity is just basically a religion of believers that somehow started getting into pagan things. But we'll see the actual religion of Christianity is something that was started in the 4th century and really had nothing to do with the early believers whatsoever. And Yahweh willing, hopefully we'll have the time that we'll be able to take it all the way into modern times, go through some of the history of the congregation in the wilderness and what they believed and what they did and what they went through. Because like it says, even in the Old Testament, when they were the children of Israel coming out of Egypt, that all these things were examples for us today. So before really getting into the early congregation, I'd like to start in Genesis 17. Because it's interesting, Yahweh willing, this week we'll get into the genealogy of Yeshua. There's two genealogies. One is in the book of Matthew. One is in the book of Luke. Luke is the legal genealogy, and it goes all the way back to Adam. But yet, in Matthew's genealogy, it starts at Abraham. Because Abraham is really where the covenant started, and Abraham is really where we see the whole need, the whole judicial order coming in together of why there has to be a Messiah, what he's going to do, the nation of Israel coming into it. So in Genesis, the 17th chapter, it says, when Abram was 99 years old, Yahweh appeared to Abram and said to him, I am El Shaddai, walk before me and be perfect, and I will make my covenant between me and you and will increase you very greatly. And Abram fell on his face, and Elohim spoke with him, saying, as for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be a father of many nations. And your name no longer shall be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham. For I have made you a father of many nations. And I will make you very fruitful exceedingly, and I will give you for nations, and kings shall come out from you. And I will establish my covenant between me and you, and your seed after you in their generations for an everlasting covenant to be an Elohim to you and to your seed after you. So here we see where, from the book of Genesis, you know, we see that where Adam failed, there had to be a seed of a woman that was going to come, but never any kind of promise of eternity and kingship and rulership and all these other things. Basically, it's that there's going to be a seed that's going to continue, that's going to right the wrongs that Adam did. And we see this through Noah, even to the point where there's a flood on the world, everybody's destroyed except for that one seed of Noah. And then he continues on through Shem, and you can see the genealogy for yourself if you look back in the book of Genesis. But now for the very first time, we're getting into a bigger picture where you're not just seeing a promise just for redemption or just to pay the penalty for Adam's seed, but you're seeing promises that are talking about eternal kingship, eternal dynasty, of having his seed like the stars of the heaven, living in this land as the rulers of the world. You know, so it's a whole different situation that's coming. And that's exactly what happened. From Abraham, we know that Abraham's seed was Isaac, and Isaac had Yaakov, and Yaakov's name is changed to Israel. Yaakov is the supplanter. You know, remember, he grabbed his brother's heel in the womb, and he changes him from the supplanter to Israel, the one who overcame with El. And then, of course, he had the 12 sons of Israel, and we know the story from there, that Yahweh had it where they went down to Egypt, and after Joseph died, and there's another Pharaoh that comes, and they're multiplying like rabbits, and they're worried that what are we going to do with these people? You know, they're going to overtake us, maybe they'll go with our enemy, and they start putting them into hard bondage and slavery. And then probably the most amazing, unbelievable story in the history of mankind, at least up to this point. We know there's a second Exodus coming that tells us we'll forget the first Exodus. But at least up to this point in mankind, that Yahweh personally intervenes and doesn't just do a miracle, but he literally takes a nation himself. He's their forefront. He's their rear guard. He does all the miracles and the plagues in Egypt. You know, even having Moses come and march the people out, parting of the Red Sea, and just an unbelievable adventure. Unfortunately, Israel still, after seeing all that, still does not believe in Yahweh. They still murmur in the wilderness. They still complain about what they don't have. And what does Yahweh say? He's ready to just destroy all of them. And this is where sometimes, like I said, the false grace comes in. That Christianity somehow thinks that Yahweh's grace and mercy is that he just loves us even though we're sinners. And he just allows us to be in our sin. And I don't see that anywhere in the Bible. I don't see that in the Old Covenant. I don't see that in the New Covenant. Where I see Yahweh's mercy is that he never gives up on people. That Yahweh allows people up to their last breath to repent of their sins, to turn from their ways, and come back to him. But if you don't, you're going to reap what you sow. And that's what Yahweh said to Moses. He said, okay, Moses, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to wipe out everyone, but I also will not be mocked. You know, those who honor me, I will honor, and those that don't honor me, you know, they're going to get their just reward. So the Israelites spent 40 years wandering in the wilderness until the whole generation dies. And then, of course, their children come up, and they don't seem much better. If you look at Moses giving his parting words right before he's ready to be buried somewhere in the valley underneath Mount Nebo, what does he say to them? He tells a prophecy for the end time, and he tells them that he knows after his death they're rebellious people, and they're going to do the same thing. And pretty much it's exactly what happens. They come into the promised land. They have Joshua with them. So as long as they have Joshua and Caleb, things are going pretty good for that first generation. They're kind of too busy fighting their enemies to worry about the paganism and all the other stuff. But as soon as Joshua and Caleb die off, you have the times of the judges, which is probably the worst time in the history of Israel. It's amazing that Yahweh, for these some odd 350 years, allowed it to keep going on and going on and going on. But then something happens that is very important in the story. 1 Samuel 8. 1 Samuel, the 8th chapter. Starting in verse 4. And I'm going through the history because I want to show you it's all tied in together. You know, when you think of Israel, we're here in the land of Israel. What is Israel? What is Israel? To us, we think of the nation of Israel, right? We're thinking of the kingship of David. We're thinking of maybe the eternal kingdom that's coming. But in the 6,000 years, this land has been here 6,000 years. Israel has only been a nation, maybe 850 out of 6,000. So about 80% of the time from creation today, Israel wasn't here. And they weren't a nation. And they weren't doing all these things. It was something totally different. So it's important in the history as we understand this. 1 Samuel 8 and verse 4. And the elders of Israel gathered and came into Samuel to Ramah. And they said to him, behold, you have become old, and your sons have not walked in your ways. Now appoint a king to us to judge us like all the nations. Problem that Israel had going back from the beginning. They wanted to mimic the nations. Yahweh was calling them out of the world to be separate. To be not just a separate people, but now to be a separate nation. And he gave them his statutes and his commandments and his judgments and his Torah. And he said, when you keep all these things, the land will bless you, the rain from heaven will come down, and then all the nations around you are going to see, wow, look how much these people are being blessed because they're obedient to Yahweh, their Elohim. And then the other people are going to say, we want in on this. So it's not that Yahweh does not want to bless them also, but again, judicial order. But we know it didn't happen that way. It happened the opposite. That Israel went to the other nations looking how they were doing it, looking at their false deities. And now they're even saying, give to us a king. And Samuel prayed to Yahweh, verse 6, and Yahweh said to Samuel, listen to the voice of the people to do all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from reigning over them. See, that was the point. Why didn't they have an earthly king? They did have a king. Simply it was Yahweh that was king over them. When we read Ezekiel 36, when we see that David will be over the people in that day, but Yahweh, Yeshua, is also with them. So always, Yahweh would be sovereign, and yet he would have an earthly body. You know, we talked about a cabinet, so to speak, that would be working with him. But the people rejected that. They didn't want Yahweh reigning over them. They wanted an earthly king. And he says, you have not rejected you, but they've rejected me from reigning over them. According to all the works that they have done, from the day I brought them from Egypt, even to this day, when they forsook me and served other Elohim, so they were also doing to you. And now listen to their voice, only protesting. You shall protest to them, and you shall declare to them the privilege of the king who's going to reign over them. We talked about all the earthly governments, right? We talked about communism and socialism and democracy, even republic, that it doesn't work. It's never worked. You can't ever give me an example of one earthly government from the time that Adam was on this earth till today that was ever a wonderful great government that loved their people and took care of them. Maybe in a fairy tale book you might see it, but not in real life. So he's going to tell them what this king will do to them. And now he says, and Samuel spoke the words of Yahweh to the people who were asking for a king from him. And he said, this is the privilege of the king who will reign over you. He'll take your sons and will appoint them for himself among his chariots and among his horsemen, and they shall run before his chariots. And he will appoint for himself heads of 1,000, heads of 50, and to plowing his plowing, and to reap his reaping, and to make weapons for war for him, and weapons for his charioteer. And he will take your daughters for perfumers, and for cooks, and for bakers. And he will take your fields, and your vineyards, and your olive yards, the best, and give them to his servants. You know, we saw what Ahab did to Nabal, right? Same kind of thing. And he will tithe your seed in your vineyards and will give them to his eunuchs and his servants. And he will take your male slaves and your slave girls and the best of your young men and your donkeys and will use them for his own work. He will tithe your flock and you will be servants to him. And you will cry out in that day because your kingdom you've chosen for yourself. And Yahweh will not answer you in that day. And the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel, but said, no, but a king shall be over us. And we shall be even we, like all the nations. And our king shall judge us and shall go out before us and fight our battles. You know, it's almost what I was talking about a couple of weeks ago in Habakkuk. You know, are we being the model for the world? Or are we just being like them? You know, whether it's internet, whether it's every new gadget that's out there, whether it's the latest fashion or craze. You know, what is it? Because it's all over the Bible. It's from the Garden of Eden until the book of Revelation. It's very simple. That Yahweh is calling a people out from Satan's world. That's what the plan is all about. And if you want to be part of Satan's world, if you like it better there, you know, like it says, even the parable to the rich man, when he's saying, you know, that the kings of the earth make friends among the wise, you know, that the people of Yahweh are not as wise as the servants of this world. But what does he say? He says that when the money fails, they will welcome you into the everlasting habitations, basically the lake of fire. You know, and he's warning them not to do it. You know, not to look for the short term. Not to look for, you know, the glamour that's right in front of you, but you have to look for the long term, the kingdom of Yahweh. You have to look into what's coming, not just what's right in front of you. But the people didn't see it. So this is a major turning point, right? Because what happens? You have 42 kings of Israel and Judah. Not one king of Israel was any good. There's not one that even remotely did what was right in Yahweh's eyes. A couple of kings of Judah were okay. I wouldn't call any righteous Even Yeshua said, no man is righteous, not one. Even when you're looking at King David, a good man, a man after Yahweh's own heart, but also an adulterer and a murderer and other problems that David had. King Solomon, who probably, there's a good chance he might not even be in the kingdom, you know, turned away from Yahweh later in his life, not earlier, between all his foreign wives and concubines. So not really a pretty picture from this point on. But Yahweh's still working with Israel. He hasn't given them up. But like I say, out of 6,000 years, Israel's only in this land 850, and it's not a good history. It really is not a good history. Read through your Bible. You don't see history of prosperousness. You don't see history of all the people serving Yahweh. You don't see any of this history anywhere. You see continuously a people that's turning from Yahweh, that's following other deities. You know, I mean, in the days of Eliyahu, it's a great story of Eliyahu's courage and Eliyahu's faith. But can you imagine there's 450 Israelite priests who are worshiping Baal? 450 at that time, you know, and that's only in the story that we know of, you know, so it's not a pretty picture. And then what eventually happens, Ezekiel 20. Now we get to the point where he's had it. Ezekiel 20, starting in verse 2. And the word of Yahweh was to me, saying, Son of man, speak to the elders of Israel and say to them, So says Adonai Yahweh, Have you come to inquire of me? As I live, declares Adonai Yahweh, I will not be inquired of by you. Will you judge them? Will you judge them, son of man? Cause them to know the abominations of their fathers. And say to them, So says Adonai Yahweh, In the day I chose Israel and lifted my hand to the seed of the house of Jacob, and I was made known to them in the land of Egypt, when I lifted up my hand to them, saying, I am Yahweh your Elohim. In the day I lifted up my hand to them to bring them out by the land of Egypt into a land flowing with milk and honey, that I had searched out for them, the glory of it is to all the lands. Then I said to them, Let each man cast away the filthy idols of his eyes, and do not defile yourself with the idols of Egypt. I am Yahweh your Elohim. But they rebelled against me and would not listen to me. They did not each man throw away the filthy items of their eye, idols of their eyes, and they did not forsake the idols of Egypt. Then I said, I will pour out my fury against them, to complete my anger against them in the midst of the land of Egypt. And I worked for my name's sake, that it should not be profaned in the eyes of the nations among whom they were. And I made myself known to them in their eyes by bringing them out of the land of Egypt. And I caused them to go out from the land of Egypt and brought them into the wilderness. And I gave them my statutes, and I made them known my judgments, which if a man does them, he will even live by them. And I also gave them my Sabbaths to be a sign between me and them, that they might know that I am Yahweh who sets them apart. Right off the bat, Isaiah 8:20, if they speak not according to the Torah and the prophets, there's no light in them. I don't care how nice a person is. I don't care what his heart is. It really doesn't make a matter to me. If somebody is claiming a seat of authority and they're telling the people that the Torah is done away with, that all these things are not relevant to us today, they're a servant of Satan. It's that evil. You know, that's simple. Because it is evil what they're doing. And it's very simple that righteousness only comes through Yahweh's law. Man cannot create his own righteousness. Every time he tries to do it, we see where it ends up. So he tells them, he gave them all these beautiful, wonderful things of his, but the house of Israel rebelled against me in the wilderness. They did not walk in my statutes, and they despised my judgments, which if a man does, he will even live in by them. And they greatly profaned my Sabbaths. Then I said, I will pour out my fury on them in the wilderness to consume them. But I worked for my namesake, that it should not be profaned in the eyes of the nations, before whom I brought them out in their eyes. And I also lifted up my hand to them in the wilderness, that it would not bring them into the land flowing with milk and honey, which I had given. It is the glory to all the lands. Because they despised my judgments, and they did not walk in my statutes, and they profaned my Sabbaths, for their heart went after their idols. And my eyes spared them from destroying them, and I did not make an end of them in the wilderness. But I said to the sons in the wilderness, Do not walk in the statutes of your fathers, and do not keep their judgments, and do not defile yourself with their idols. I am Yahweh your Elohim, walk in my statutes, and keep my judgments, and do them, and guard my Sabbaths to keep them holy, and they shall be a sign between me and you, that you may know that I am Yahweh your Elohim. Pretty simple, his rebuke to Israel. I say today, you look around Israel, it's the same today. You know, 2 weeks ago, they're having a big bike race on Shabbat, you know, violating the commandment. Yahweh didn't go through 2,500 years of diaspora. He didn't work every miracle in the world to bring a nation back here for bike races on the Sabbath. He also didn't bring them back to open up shopping malls and buying fashion clothes on Shabbat, running buses on Shabbat or anything else. So we see the same things that happen here. They will happen. There's no doubt about it. I will guarantee you 1,000%, because Yahweh's the same yesterday, today, and forever. And the same way that he's telling his people here that the commandments are forever, that the Sabbath is a sign between him and his children, it's the same for us today. Nothing has changed. So what happens here? We know because of their rebellion to Yahweh, their refusal to listen. First, in 734 BC, there's the first siege that comes on the north, and the king of Assyria, Sennacherib, he comes into Gilead, he comes into Galilee, all these areas are taken over, you know, and he starts controlling it. Then from 721 to 718 BC, about maybe 13 years later, he completely takes out all the Israelites. Now it's interesting, at that time, they actually have, from the Assyrian annals, they talk about that capture, and they say that Sargon the general, at that time from Tiglath-Pileser, he was the king, that Sargon captured 27,290, something like that, Israelites. You can look in the Bible, you can see right before this, there's one battle where there's more than 500,000 soldiers alone, not even counting all the men and women and everything else. So clearly there was much more Israelites than that. So what happened? If only 27,000 are taken and then there's no more in the land, what happened to the some odd 2 million Israelites? And we know what happened to them from history. It tells us some of them actually migrated down to the south, a portion of them. When they saw how bad things were getting, they had Elijah's drought, they assimilated with Judah. We know that even in the first century, there was a portion of Jews who were Israelites. We know from Ezekiel 37, he says, take one stick for Judah and his companions, the sons of Israel. But that was a small portion, maybe 10%. The rest of them, they migrated down to what we would know today as Africa. At that time, it was called the Carthage Empire, Tunisia, Libya, Egypt. And then they migrated south from there. Some of them went over to Parthia and the Black Sea area, to what would be modern-day Russia and Ukraine and those areas like that. Some went all the way east as far as Afghanistan and India. They have the white Indians that they found, that their skulls and their makeup are exactly like Israelites. They have menorahs on their gravestones. They have all in their languages. Some of the people from Afghanistan that were called Sakai, the tribe of the Sakai, the sons of Isaac. Then some of them from there migrated over to Europe later, to places that were originally Gaul, that became France and Great Britain, Norway, and all the other areas, you know, and we know it. I'm not going to get into too much of the history, but just showing that these people were basically in diaspora all over the earth. Never said that Ephraim would ever be a great nation. But yet it says in Hosea the 9th chapter, Ephraim would be a wanderer among the nations. So it wasn't a blessing that Ephraim, you're going to be wicked and evil and break my laws, and I'm going to cast you out to the earth, and someday you're going to become the United States of America, and you're going to become Great Britain and rule the world. No, that's not what it says, and that's not who they are. I know there's people that will believe that and say that falsely. It's called British Israelitism, which is a racist doctrine and something we do not preach, because it's not biblical and it's not accurate. The fact that you could have Israelites living in Great Britain or America does not make Great Britain and America the land of Israel. When Israel in 586 BC, when the Jews were taken into captivity in Babylon, and there were several million that were taken there, did all of a sudden Babylon become the land of Israel? Because now 2 million Jews are living there? No, not whatsoever. So then we see, like we said, this happened 721. You have a short period of time there where Judah is still not believing that they could be cast out because they control Jerusalem, and that's Yahweh's throne, and Yahweh's going to dwell there forever. So we're safe. We're never going to get cast out. They don't do much better than Israel did. We know that there's a king named Manasseh who did worse than any king that was with them before that. And Manasseh, because of that, Yahweh says to Manasseh that, you know, he's just going to take Judah away from being a nation. Of course, we know after that, there's King Josiah, who's a real good, righteous king, but it didn't make a difference. The setting was already set. Israel was going to go into captivity. And like we said, we know from 609 BC, the first siege that was coming on Jerusalem, going all the way to 573. There's five different sieges by the Babylonians. The last siege in 586, they destroy what we know as the temple, and then they leave some vagrants there for a few years, but that didn't go that well either. And eventually they all wind up down in Egypt. So now the land is basically desolate, and Yahweh says the land is going to rest from that time. Yahweh did specifically give the time period, though, that Judah would be out of the land. He said it would be 70 years that they would have rest in the land. And then in 539 BC, 70 years from the first siege, what happens? The Persian king, Cyrus, they come in, they sneak into Babylon by night, they divert the water into a different direction, they come underneath the gate, they open up the two leaf doors, just like it talks about in Isaiah 45, and in one night, they totally sack Babylon. Jeremiah 50 and 51 talks about end time Babylon's destruction. When you look at Jeremiah 50 and 51 and the complete destruction, that never happened in 539 BC. There's no fleeing of Jews. There's no mass murdering of people. Nothing. One night, without even really a big battle, they came in, they overtook the Babylonians. King Cyrus finds out that this was actually written about him in the Bible by Yahweh. He's so impressed that he says, wow, I'm going to let the Jews not only go back to Jerusalem, I'm not only going to support you rebuilding the temple, I'll give you a royal guard, I'll pay for everything, I'll give you everything that you need, you know, just you let me know what it's going to be. So then the Jews come back, they start rebuilding the second temple now. We know from the book of Nehemiah, he's building the walls and all the things over there. And it's not really such a real, real happy time, though, for a very simple reason. When you see the glory, it talks about in Haggai of the second temple, and they looked at it compared to Solomon's temple, the people actually cried because some of them were alive and saw Solomon's temple, and now they're seeing, you know, this temple that never had the Shekinah. The Ark of the Covenant was not there. The Shekinah glory was never in that temple either. And it was just a very different situation. Israel was not a sovereign nation the way they were before. They had no king. They had no nothing. You know, they were basically back there. Only 10% of the people came from Babylon. Most of them stayed in Babylon and said, hey, I got a good life in Babylon. I don't need to go there and have people shooting at us from the walls and risk the life of us and our family. So it was a really, really hard time. We know in 457 BC, that's when the decree goes out from Daniel, the 70 weeks, to rebuild and restore Jerusalem. So you could do your math from there and count 483 years till the time the Messiah is going to come. But it's a very much, you could say, a black hole in the history of the Jewish people from that point. Matter of fact, maybe we'll just get into a little more of the history before we get down into the 4th century. But after that, what happens? You have the Persians that are kings until about 350 AD. And then all of a sudden, the Greeks come in. And Alexander the Great, he's a young general, full of zeal, 20 years old. And within 12 years, he conquers the world. Does something that nobody ever did before. All the way even till today, there's remnants of his battles that were going in Mongolia and Afghanistan, you know, coming all the way from Greece. And then at 32 years old, he gets poisoned by somebody. He dies. His kingdom is separated into his four generals. But the two important ones are the Seleucids to the north in Syria and the Ptolemies to the south in Egypt. And you can see that Israel is right in between, so they're kind of like a Greek sandwich in between there. And whenever the Ptolemies are stronger, Israel is subservient to the Ptolemies. Whenever the Seleucids are stronger, Israel is subservient to them. And this is where the black hole kind of comes into history. If you look in the Talmud, in the Mishnah, they say from about 350 BC to 170 BC, there's really no great rabbis. Their history, they don't even have a history. There's no great rabbis that's preaching. But what's happening is their civilization is being what was called Hellenized. They're very much being assimilated into the Greek history. You know, if you look in the first century, some of you that came to Caesarea, you saw the hippodrome there. You saw the theater. These are things that you would never see in ancient Israel. You know, the whole culture, even sometimes how we know the time period is by the Corinthian pillars. You know, in the Herodian time period, everything was built according to the Greek and the Roman culture that you didn't have back then. But again, what's going to happen? The same as we said, Yahweh's whole plan was to keep his people separated from the world. And if they're not separated, you're going to assimilate and you're going to be like them. You know, we're going to see that this is something that started with Abraham and still goes until today. In the wilderness, it was the same thing. You will see some of the most strongest of faith, good, righteous, holy people. And then all of a sudden, what was the disaster? Yahweh blessed them and they grew in numbers. And every time the number got too big, what would happen? You know, as it got too big, you would have people that would want to assimilate and be part of the world. And then the remnant would have to break off and move on. And then the other people would become part of the world. It's happened over and over and over again from the beginning. And that's why today, you might have 2 billion people in the world that technically, their lineage goes back to Israelite to some way. Are they Israelite today? Absolutely not. You know, they've intermarried, they've interwoven in the different societies. So the fact that maybe if you put their lineage long ago, to 2,000-3,000 years ago, they can go back to one of the 12 tribes, doesn't mean anything today. Because they have no connection. They have no connection to the ancient culture or the people or whatever. So this is what started to happen. They had this great Hellenization. That's when they brought in the kippah. Talks about in the book of Maccabees, you know, that the Greeks forced the little skull cap that comes from the false god Hermes. And that's when they started doing those things. They started going to gymnasium. You know, gymnasium, you've heard that word before. It's a Greek word. It means naked men. Because that's where they're coming and they're doing all their gymnastics and they're doing all their things. And they're, you know, there's a whole different culture that's coming. So it's very different now that even though Israel is still living in this land, they're not sovereign. There is no King David. There is no King Saul. There isn't even a King Ahab. You know, they're basically just people that are here that are trying to survive. So now what happens? You get to the year 196 BC, really important year for two reasons. Number one, you get a religious movement coming out of that's saying we need to do something. If we don't do something, Judaism will be ended. We'll lose our whole culture. We'll be completely assimilated with the nations. So they came up with something called the Sanhedrin. We read about it even in chapter 6 of Acts. The Sanhedrin was a group of 70 elders, a council, 35 Pharisees, 35 Sadducees, and one high priest. Who are the Pharisees and the Sadducees? We'll talk about it in a minute when we get into Antioch Epiphanes. And yet the Essenes, they realized there was a corruption here. They realized that things were not the way that Yahweh had made it. They were not part of it. So the Essenes go down to Qumran. They leave the community in Jerusalem. They go down to Qumran. They did have other places in Israel, but that's their main place that they're going at that time. So it's interesting, though, the same year that the Sanhedrin starts is the same year that the Essenes are separating. And that's why I said all the time, it always, something would get big, they would get worldly and corrupted, and there's always a remnant that would leave and that they would move on. Then, during the year 169-170 BC, you have the Syrian king, Antiochus Epiphanes, a Seleucid king, that he becomes very strong. He's trying to unite the whole empire. And now, how is he going to do that? He's saying, these Jews are stopping it. They're too rigid. They're too much into their own way. They're too separated. We're going to have to stop it. So where the Jews, as far as culture goes, they were falling in line. They were following the culture. They had no problem with it. They liked the nice, dainty things of the Greek culture. But now when he said, you cannot circumcise your children, your male children on the eighth day, you're not going to be able to keep Shabbat, you know, you're not going to be able to do these things, what happens? They revolt. And there's a man called Matthias Maccabees from Moedim near the airport. He has three sons, you know, that are going to be with him. And they're going to fight. Judas Maccabees, Yonatan Maccabees, Shimon Maccabees. And they're going to fight a guerrilla war. Because really, they're a small priestly family. They're farmers. They're not military. They don't have an army. They don't have these things. But they start this guerrilla war in the hills of Moedim. They spread out. And to the amazement of themselves in history, they start winning these battles. They start winning the battles. In the book of Daniel, it says that the temple would be 2,300 evening in mornings. It would be desecrated until it was rededicated 1,150 days. And exactly to the day, 1,150 days from when Antiochus Epiphanes burned a pig on the altar in Jerusalem, what they call the abomination of desolation. Exactly 1,150 days later was the day of Hanukkah. Hanukkah, which means rededication. And that's when they retook the temple. They came in. Actually, the story, I don't know if you ever heard of a story that they only had oil for one day and the menorah burned for 9 days. That's not in any writing. That's an oral tradition. That may be just a legend, but even in the Talmud and the Mishnah, it's not written. It's not written anywhere there, but it is a story that Jews tell from generation to generation. But we do know, which is a fact, the temple was rededicated. The temple was rededicated, and one of the sons of Simon becomes the priest, and the man, John Hyrcanus, who's also, they're called Hasmoneans now, because that's where they come from. So the Pharisees are more of a working, more for the working class. They're people that are more into all the oral writings that were coming up from the 2nd century BC, and they're into this. The Hasmoneans were people that became the Sadducees. They only believed in the five books of Moses. They didn't believe in all the other writings. They were wealthy, they were aristocrats, and as we see the time going on here, they actually sold the priesthood to people that were not Levites and not priests. So their problems really didn't get better, they only got worse. They only got worse. And now there's all of this infighting and structure that's going on within them. 67 BC now, we get to the point that a man by the name of John Hyrcanus, he's a Hasmonean, he's backed by the Pharisees. He fought his brother Aristobulus, who's a Sadducee. The two brothers are fighting each other, and they call Rome for help. They're calling Rome for help. In 63 BC, Pompey comes in. There is actually a king who was an Armenian king that, unbeknownst to Rome, was coming down into this area. And why is this area important? You know, if all you're having is fighting and interfighting, and there's no gold that they're looking for, there's no resources that they're looking for, why would they care about Israel? Because Israel is the gateway to the Middle East. You know, when you look, the ports of Tyre, you know, in Sidon, you know, where they call the Iron Triangle, where the ships of Tarshish would come from Spain and come over here to Tyre, and they would go to the whole world. So this is why it was an extremely important place, because it connected Europe to the Middle East, just as today. You know, that's why it's an extremely important place. So as Rome starts to see the Armenian king is coming down toward what we would know today as Lebanon, the area in the north of Israel, what does he do? He decides that he's got to go and fight. He conquers the Armenian king, and now Israel, as we know it, is controlled by the Romans, and they rename it Palestine. That's where the name Palestine comes from. They don't like the Jewish people very much because the Jewish people don't like them very much. And again, they're trying to fight against the Roman occupation. And I said this before, if you were a Roman soldier and you were sent to Jerusalem, either you really, really had somebody upset or you did some kind of punishment. You did something wrong. It was not the place you wanted to come to. It would be today being banished over to the West Bank, you know, being banished to Nablus or Jenin, you know, into one of those places if you'd survive. That was the way that they looked at it in those days. And when Rome comes in here, they divide it into four areas. They have Judea, Samaria, Galilee, and Perea on the other side of the Jordan River. Judea, Samaria, Galilee, and Perea. Then in 53 BC, Pompey, Julius Caesar, and Crassus' alliance from Rome falls apart. Crassus dies. Caesar beats Pompey in a war, and although Rome is still a republic, Caesar takes totalitarian rule. So now Rome is changing itself. They're going from a republic that's led by their Congress to more of a totalitarian rule. And after Julius Caesar, everyone will be called Caesar. It becomes a title. For Julius Caesar, it was his actual name, was Julius Caesar. Aristobulus is in prison for years under Pompey. He makes friends with Caesar. He's released, and he's poisoned, and he dies. Hyrcanus makes a pact with Caesar. He declares the high priesthood is hereditary to Hyrcanus' line in return. So you see a lot of now political maneuvering going on, but it's going to affect the priesthood that's in Jerusalem. And these things are important as we start getting into New Testament stories. And hopefully you'll understand the stories a little more by understanding the background. There's a man called Antipater II. He's a wealthy Edomite. He's a powerful landowner, and he's an ally of Pompey. He now makes an ally with Caesar. He becomes more powerful in Israel than Hyrcanus the high priest. And his son becomes governor of Galilee. His name is Herod the Great. Herod the Great is the son of Antipater. He makes close ties with his Roman overlords. He suppresses his Jewish subjects. Herod's wife was a descendant of the Hasmoneans. So you see now how the Hasmoneans, who were descendants from the Maccabees, Herod marries into that, figuring it's going to help him in his political premise. But Herod realizes really quick that he's not going to get too far. The Jews don't like him. Even though under the time of the Maccabees, in a place called Mereshah, some of you were with us there, Bet Gorvin, remember when we were there and we went in the underground caves that were over there. At the time, most of the people that were there that were Edomites were converted to Judaism. So Herod was half Jew, you know, at least through his conversion. But the Jews didn't like him. They knew that he wasn't dedicated or loyal to the religion of Judaism or the people of Judaism. And he realized right away that his best bet was being loyal to Rome, not to his Jewish subjects. And the more that he can oppress his Jewish subjects, the better it was going to be for his political life. I'll read you here this about his wealth, just to show you the wealth of Herod. It says, according to one estimate, Herod's yearly income was at least 13 million denarii, a sum equal in today's terms of over $1.6 million. His wealth accrued from several sources. Taxes on agricultural produce, for example, was a fourth, a third on grain, and up to one half of the yield on fruit. Until Cleopatra took them from him, Herod owned balsam plantations in Jericho and in Gedi, manufacturing a perfume from this mysterious plant that was worth its weight in gold. Herod extracted tolls and duties from the caravans bringing spices, like frankincense and myrrh, from Arabia across his territories to the port in Gaza. And remember, Herod originally was from Edomia, Nabataeans, you know, coming over there. So all of the spice routes, he had his hand in all of that from his father. Much of the economy of Judea was stimulated by the existence of the temple. Doves and other animals were raised for sacrifice. Some of you got to see, actually, where he did this. And sold in the markets of Jerusalem together with incense and all other items required by visitors and pilgrims. Of all these, Herod imposed taxes. So although he was an evil person, I mean, he was an extremely evil person. We'll see what he did to his family. He was at least, he was smart. He was a businessman. Then in 44 BC, Julius Caesar is murdered by Brutus and Cassius Mark Antony, who's the official from Egypt, and Caesar's nephew Octavian. Octavian becomes Augustus Caesar, take over. There's a struggle for control. Mark Antony goes to Egypt with Princess Cleopatra. Octavian paints him as a traitor. They battle off the coast of Greece, and Augustus wins. Mark Antony goes back to Egypt and kills himself. Augustus is now the emperor. So Octavian, who becomes Augustus Caesar, is now the emperor. Antipater's father, Herod's father, was poisoned at this time. Then in 37 BC, after many battles, Herod takes control under Rome of Jerusalem. So ruthless and paranoid that he has his wife, Mariana, and her mother, Alexandra, killed because they were too close with him. This is Herod now. So he kills his wife, he kills his mother. He was also pretty close with the Emperor Augustus. He then has his two sons, Aristobulus and Alexander, killed because he's afraid they may try to overtake the throne. And then Augustus, the Caesar, says, it is better to be Herod's pig than to be Herod's son. Two sages, when they heard that Herod was on his deathbed, Herod put this gigantic golden eagle up on the temple of Yahweh. And when they heard he was on his deathbed, they went up and they ripped the temple down. And Herod had them buried alive. We know from Matthew 2, maybe we'll go there. We know what he did in the New Testament. So it shouldn't surprise us when we read about some of his background. And when Yeshua had been born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, Magi arrived from the east to Jerusalem, saying, where is he born of the king of the Jews? For we saw his star in the east and have come to worship him. But Herod the king, having heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And having gathered all the chief priests and the scribes of the people, he asked for them where the Messiah was to be born. And they sent him in Bethlehem of Judea, so it had been written by the prophet. And you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judea, in no way are you least among the governors of Judah. For out of you shall come out one ruling, who shall be shepherd my people Israel. Then secretly calling the Magi, Herod asked of them exactly the time of the star appearing. And sending them to Bethlehem, he said, having gone, exactly inquire about the child. And when you find him, bring me word again, so that coming I may also worship him. And having heard the king, they departed, and behold, the star which they saw in the east went before them until it had come and stood over where the child was. Then I'll drop down to verse 12, and having been warned by a dream not to return to Herod, they went back to their own country another way. And having departed, a cherub of Yahweh appeared to Joseph by a dream, saying, rise up, take the child and his mother with you, and flee into Egypt, and be there until I shall tell you. For Herod is about to look for the child in order to destroy him. Again, you always see this, the seed, trying to kill the seed. And rising up, Joseph took along his child and his mother by night and withdrew to Egypt. And he was there until the end of Herod, that might be fulfilled, spoken by Yahweh through the prophet, saying, out of Egypt I had called my son. Then seeing that he was mocked by the Magi, Herod was greatly enraged, and having sent, he killed all the boys in Bethlehem and in all its district, from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he exactly was asked from the Magi. So we see just a ruthless person. Killed his own wife, killed his own her mother, killed his children, and killed here all the babies. After Herod's death, Herod the Great, and now Herod is also a title. There's other Herods that we're going to see. The kingdom is divided between Archelaus, his son, Philip Herod, that ruled up here in the north, Antipas Herod, who ruled Galilee. And then in 26 AD, a man by the name of Pontius Pilate, he takes over rule in Judea. And Augustus Caesar dies at the age of 76 in 14 AD. And this is what you're dealing with as Yeshua is coming on the scene. So, before his ministry, you're in total disarray. You have a divided country. You have even within the religious realm, you know, you have the Sadducees that are now aristocrats. They're doing pretty good. They're political appointments. They're trying to keep the status quo. And then you have the Pharisees that are more for the average people. They're more of the zealous religious people. You know, their beliefs are very different. You know, the Pharisees go by the oral law. They believe in reincarnation, all these things. The Sadducees are only believing in the five books of Moses. The Sadducees control the temple because they are the priests. Pharisees are not priests, but the Pharisees control the synagogues. So again, even though the Hagim, the pilgrim feasts are all being controlled in Jerusalem on a weekly basis, you know, things are being controlled by the Pharisees. And of course, like I said, we have the Essenes that withdrew from all of this. They're not even part of the system. And then you also have people that are called zealots. Zealots are religious people that want to take back by force. They're freedom fighters. They want to fight against Rome. They want to have a physical war. And they want to take it back. So now you have Rome, who is the occupier. And Israel is important to their kingdom. They can't lose it. Because again, they have enemies that go east of Israel, in Parthia and these other areas. So they need to keep the peace here. They try to appease the Jews as much as possible, but at the same rate, if you're on the wrong side of the law, they're going to be ruthless. They're not going to put up with a minute for insurrection or anything that's going to come against their rule. As a matter of fact, even on the day of Yom Kippur, they would hold the priestly garments in Fort Antonia, and if the Jews caused any kind of disturbance, they wouldn't give the priestly garments to the priests, so he couldn't keep Yom Kippur. So now this is what you're dealing with. Now if you're an average person, and you're living here at that time, there's times that there were up to 500 people being crucified a day on trees. Just think how you would feel. You know, if you're a person that is believing in the Torah, you know, you're looking for the promises of Israel, you see all this disarray, you see all this religious hypocrisy, and on the other end, you see people who just don't even care. It's kind of everybody out for themselves. So it wasn't really a time of real hope for the people. They didn't know what was going to come from there. And they were very scared also. You know, were the Romans just going to do away with all of us? What's going to happen? But one thing is, because of the prophecy in Daniel, they knew they had messianic expectations. They were all looking for a second Moses. They were looking for a deliverer. They didn't know how he would come. They didn't know why he would come. But they all knew something's going to come. Someone's going to come. A matter of fact, from the beginning of the first century AD, we know when we look in history, there were at least 10 or 20 false messiahs that showed up. People that were coming that were trying to get armies together, that were going to fight, and then it didn't happen. Then another one came, and it didn't happen. Then another one came, and it didn't happen. So you could see that even though they didn't want to lose hope, they didn't know where to turn to. They were very, very much in disarray. What do we do from here? How do our lives change? How did we get to this spot? We're the chosen people. You know, how did we get from parting of the Red Sea and being here under King David just a few hundred years ago? How did we get to this spot? And that's the way that people believe. But certainly they were not looking for spiritual analogies. They weren't looking for a warm, fuzzy feeling in the heart. They were looking for King David. They were looking for somebody that was going to be able to free them. That this tortured life that they've had now for the last several hundred years was going to be over. So let's start looking at some scriptures, understanding the background, and try to piece it all together. Luke, the 6th chapter. Or John, I'm sorry. John, the 6th chapter. Verse 14 and 15. John 6 and verse 14 and 15. Then seeing what miracle signs Yeshua did, the men said, "This is truly the prophet." What prophet? Remember we went over it in Deuteronomy 18? They're thinking, Yeshua's got to be it. He's the prophet that Moses talked about. Truly, they said, the one coming into the world. Then knowing that they were about to come and seize him, that they might make him king, Yeshua withdrew again to the mountain alone by himself. So as soon as they saw everything he was doing, they were going to, by force, say, come on, take over the kingship. We believe it. You're the guy. Do what you're supposed to do. Luke 24. Luke 24 and verse 19. This is when Yeshua is on the road to Emmaus, remember? And they didn't know who he was. And they're saying, don't you know the things that have happened the last few days? Luke 24 and verse 19. And he said to them, what things? And they said to him, the things concerning Yeshua the Nazarene, who was a man, a prophet, mighty indeed in word before Elohim and all the people. And how the chief priests and our rulers delivered him to the judgment of death and crucified him. But we were hoping that he is the one going to redeem Israel. But then with all these things, the third day comes today since these things happened. They were hoping he was going to be the one to redeem Israel. So are you getting in your mind? See, we're looking at this 2,000 years later. And like I said, all of us are brought up from a Christian perspective. You know, we're brought up that with the Christian theology. You know, Jesus died for our sins and we all need to accept that. Which is true to that degree. But like I said, for these people, they didn't have that theology. They didn't understand that. When they were looking at a Messiah, they were looking for one thing. They were looking for a second David. They were looking for a guy that was going to be strong, that was going to be led by Yahweh, that was going to follow the Torah, and was going to kill their enemies. It was that simple. That's what they were looking for. They didn't understand the other parts. They didn't understand that if Yeshua would have taken over as king, none of them would have been in the kingdom. Because all of them committed sins under the first covenant that were never paid for. But you have to understand the mentality to understand what they're thinking about. Acts 1, Acts the first chapter. This is after Yeshua is resurrected. He's right, getting ready to ascend to heaven. In verse 3, Acts 1 and verse 3. Those who also to whom he revealed himself while alive after he had suffered, with numerous signs for 40 days, he was being seen by them, and he spoke concerning the kingdom of Yahweh. And while he ate bread with them, he charged them not to leave Jerusalem, but to wait for the promise of the Father which they had heard of me. For John indeed baptized in water, but you will be baptized in the Holy Spirit not many days from here. Then indeed coming together, they questioned him, saying, Master, do you restore the kingdom to Israel at this time? Now this is after he's resurrected, and they're still not understanding. You know, what's going on here? You know, are you going to restore the kingdom to Israel at this time? Luke 6 and verse 15. Luke 6 and verse 15. Talking about the apostles, Matthew and Thomas, Jacob the son of Alphaeus, and Simon the one being called Zealot. Simon the one being called Zealot. So Simon is a zealot. And what is a zealot? A zealot was one of the ones, like we said, that they wanted to take the kingdom by force. So again, I'm trying to give you a background that you're understanding under what parameters the New Testament is being written and the mindset of the people. That they weren't Christians. They weren't being born knowing that they all internally have sin and we all need somebody to pay the penalty of our sin. That was not a concept to them. They had no idea about this. This is something that had to be revealed to them later through the scriptures. But they were pragmatic people. They're under occupation. Every single person had somebody in their family that was killed. And they're looking to have their lives changed. You know, you had unbelievable famines that were going on in the land. Matter of fact, when the Romans destroyed the temple, how did they do it? You know, there was the great revolt in 66. The Jews came and overtook Fort Antonia. Things looked good for maybe up to a year. But then the Romans said, that's it. We're not playing games anymore. They came in 68 with Titus and Vespasian. They made a surrounding around the city. They cut off any food and supplies and water. And they basically just starved the people out. If you read Josephus about it, you'll see that literally people were eating their children. Today we'll eat my child, tomorrow we'll eat your child. And that's how bad it got. But that's the way they would do it. They say, hey, why should we go in there and have some of our soldiers killed in fighting? Close off the city, starve them out, let them kill each other, and then we'll go in when they're too weak for who's ever left to clean it up. But this is the way they were looking at it. So the apostles, the same. At least probably two, even being zealots, they were thinking to themselves. They knew Yeshua was the Messiah. They believed it. We know that Peter, remember at Caesarea Philippi, he said, "You are the Messiah, the Son of Yahweh." But they were all waiting. At what point is he going to fight? At what point? Okay, we hear the love. We hear forgiving our enemy. We hear all these things. We agree. They're real nice sayings, you know. But at what point now, you're the Messiah, at what point are you going to bring this kingdom back to us? And there's a point when this happens that Yeshua says some things to them that they're thinking this is the time it's going to happen. And what is that? His very last Passover. Let's go to Luke 22. Luke 22. In verse 23. Luke 22 and verse 23. And they began to inquire among themselves, who then it may be of them, the one being about to do this. Yeshua just said to them, one of you is going to betray me. And there was also a dispute among them, who of them seems to be greater? And Yeshua said to them, the king of the Gentiles are their masters. And those who are authorities over them are called doers of good. But you be not so. But the greater among you, let him be as the lesser, and the one governing as the one serving. For who is greater, the one reclining or the one serving? Is it not the one reclining? Yet I am in your midst as one serving. But you are those continuing with me during my trial. And I appoint a kingdom to you, as my Father appointed to me, that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom. And you will sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. Wow. What do you think they're thinking at this point? You know, they're hearing this now. They're going to be sitting on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. Then Peter, he tells Peter he's going to deny him. Then verse 35. And he said to them, when I sent you out without purse or wallet or sandals, did you lack anything? And they said, nothing. Then he said to them, but now the one having a purse, let him take it. Likewise also a wallet. And the one having, let him sell his garment and let him buy a sword. Finally we're going to go. We're going to fight. For I say to you that this that has been written must be fulfilled in me. And he was numbered with the wicked, for the things concerning me will be fulfilled. And they said, Master, behold, here are two swords. He said to them, it is sufficient. Now, they didn't know that the reason why he's saying this is, according to Roman law, you had to have at least two weapons to get the death penalty. If not, it's not an insurrection. So he's saying it simply said he can fulfill the prophecy and be arrested as an insurrectionist and be put to death. But what are they thinking? They're thinking it's time to fight. It's time to fight. Finally, he's going to fight. Finally, we're going to get everything he's talking about. Then we drop down to verse 47. And as he was yet speaking, behold, a crowd. He's in the Garden of Gethsemane. And one called Judas, one of the 12, came in front of them and drew near to Yeshua in order to kiss him. And Yeshua said to him, Judas, do you betray the Son of Man with a kiss? And those around him, seeing what was about to recur, they said to him, Master, shall we strike with the sword? And a certain one of them struck the slave of the high priest and cut off his right ear. We know that it's Simon Peter. And answering, Yeshua said, allow it until this. And touching his ear, he healed him. Then we know what happens after that. They took him away, and the apostles all fled. And they're wondering, what on earth happened? What happened? Wasn't he just telling us that we're going to be over the 12 tribes of Israel? Didn't he tell us to get swords? We know he's the Son of Yahweh. What's going on here? So when you see the doubt that's coming later, the doubt isn't coming from him being the Messiah. The doubt is coming from, what is the plan? What is the plan? You know, we're under occupation, we're being killed every day. Okay, we don't understand this. We know you're the Messiah. We believe in that. We're believing in the resurrection. But what now? When will Israel be restored to its former greatness? Matthew 26, verse 59. And And the chief priests and the elders and the whole Sanhedrin looked for false testimony against Yeshua so they might put him to death, but they did not find any. Even though there were many false witnesses coming forward, they did not find any. But at last coming up, two false witnesses said, "This one said, I am about to destroy the sanctuary of Elohim and in 3 days to rebuild it." And standing up, the high priest said to him, "Do you answer nothing? What do these witness against you?" But Yeshua kept silent. And answering, the high priest said to him, "I put you on oath by the living Elohim that you tell us if you were the Messiah, the son of Elohim." Yeshua said to him, "You said it, I tell you more. From this time you will see the Son of Man sitting off the right hand of Yahweh in power and coming on the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his garment, saying, "He has blasphemed. Why do we have any more need of witnesses? Behold, now you have heard his blaspheme. What does it seem to you?" And answering, they said, "He is deserving of death." Now, we know from Talmudic writings that if somebody commits blasphemy, they are to get scourged. But if you commit blasphemy using the name of Yahweh, it's the death penalty. So we clearly know Yeshua used the sacred name here. There's no doubt about it. Also, Leviticus 24, 16 says similar. Leviticus 24:16 says, "And he who blasphemes the name of Yahweh surely shall die. All the congregation will certainly cast stones at him. And as to the alien, to the native, when he blasphemes the name, he shall be executed." And chances are, when Yeshua was being crucified, they were also pelting him with stones as he was up there. John 18, they just had one problem though. According to Roman law, they didn't have the ability to put somebody to death. So although according to their law, they would have wanted to, according to Roman law, they couldn't. John 18 and verse 29. And this is now when Yeshua is with Pilate. "Then Pilate went out to them and said, 'What accusation do you bring against this man?' And they said to him, 'This, if this one were not an evildoer, then we would not have delivered him to you.' Then Pilate said to them, 'You take him and judge him according to your own law.' Then the Jews said to him, 'It is not lawful for us to put anyone to death, that the word of Yeshua, which he said might be fulfilled, signifying by what kind of death he was about to die.' Then Pilate again went into the praetorium and called Yeshua and said to him, 'Are you the king of the Jews?' Yeshua answered him, 'Do you say this from your heart? Or does others tell you about me?' Pilate answered, 'Am I a Jew? Your nation, even the chief priests, deliver you up to me. What did you do?' Yeshua answered, 'My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have fought that I might not be delivered to the Jews. But now my kingdom is not from here.' Then Pilate said to him, 'Are you really a king?' Yeshua answered, 'You say that I am a king. For this purpose I have been born, and for this I have come into the world, that I might witness to the truth. Everyone being of the truth hears my voice.' Pilate said to him, 'What is truth?' And saying this, he again went out to the Jews and said, 'I do not find even one crime in him.'" And he knew they were only trying to kill him because of their envy. And we know that Pilate's wife had a dream saying, "Don't get involved with this man, he's righteous." And Pilate's trying to get him off the hook because he realizes he doesn't want to be the conduit because they're trying to kill him because of something in Jewish law. Yet at the same rate before that, what happens? Matthew 22. So his crime in the end is insurrection. Remember, according to Roman law, they put on top of you what your crime is. And what did they say? "Here is Yeshua of Nazareth, the king of the Jews." That was his crime. His crime was claiming to be a king. According to Roman law, that's death if you do that. And that's why in Matthew 22 and verse 15... "Then going, the Pharisees took counsel how they might trap him in words. And they sent him their disciples with the Herodians, saying, 'Teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of Yahweh in truth. And it does not concern you about anyone, for you do not look to the face of man. Then tell us, what do you think? Is it lawful to give the head tax to Caesar or not?' And knowing their wickedness, Yeshua said, 'Why do you tempt me, you hypocrites?'" Now, why was this such a loaded question? Because there was no answer you can give. Remember, Rome is killing 500 Jews a day. And if he says, yes, it's lawful to give taxes to Caesar, what do you think they're using the tax money for? They're using the tax money to kill Jews. But if he says, no, it's not lawful to give the money to Caesar, then what's going to happen? They're going to go back to the government and say, this man is causing insurrection. He's telling people not to pay his tax. So it was a trick question. Either way, whatever he answered, they were going to get him. But Yeshua has the perfect answer. And that's why he says, why do you tempt me, you hypocrites? He says, show me the tribute coin. And they brought it the nearest to him. And he said to them, whose image and inscription is this? You know, just like Yahweh, we're made in his likeness and his image. But he says, whose image and inscription is this? They said to him, Caesar's. Then he said to them, then give to Caesar the things of Caesar, and to Elohim the things of Elohim. And hearing, they marveled, and leaving him, they went their way. So again, this was where they were so evil, trying to trap him. And he's dealing in these circumstances where you had a occupying government. You know that you're going to get in trouble here. You had the religious authorities. You're getting trouble here. And he was in a no-win situation. Back to John 19. Verse 6. Then when the chief priests and the guards saw him, they cried out, saying, crucify, crucify. Pilate said to them, you take him and crucify him. I do not find one crime in him. So Pilate, still not trying to be used by them, as he knows what they're doing. Then the Jews answered him, we have a law, and according to our law, he ought to die, because he made himself son of Elohim. Then when Pilate heard this, he was more afraid. And he entered into the praetorium again and said to Yeshua, from where are you? But Yeshua did not give him an answer. So Pilate said to him, do you not speak to me? Do you not know that I have authority to crucify you? And I have authority to release you? Yeshua answered, you would have no authority over me whatsoever if it had not been given to you from above, judicial order. Because of this, he who delivered me to you, his sin is greater than yours. And because of this, Pilate was wanting to release him, but the Jews were crying out, if you release this man, you're not a friend of Caesar. For everyone who makes himself a king is an adversary of Caesar. Now when Pilate heard this, he brought Yeshua outside and sat upon the judgment seat in a place that is called the pavement of stones, but in Hebrew it's called Gabbatha, outcropping knoll, the stone in the praetorium. And it was preparation of the Passover, and about the sixth hour he said to the Jews, behold your king. But they were crying, take him away, crucify him, crucify him. Pilate said to him, should I crucify your king? The chief priest said to him, we have no king but Caesar. What hypocrisy. Therefore then they delivered him up that he might be crucified. And they took Yeshua and led him away. So, now we see what's behind here. Let's go to one or two more scriptures before we end for today. Luke 23 and verse 31. Luke 23 and verse 31. Yeshua said, if they do these things in a live tree, what may take place in the dry? So literally, he is being killed in a living tree. He's not being killed on a dead piece of wood. People ask, what did he carry? He would have carried the cross beam. He could not carry a cross. As a matter of fact, they did not even do crucifixions in Jerusalem. There's no hardwood forest. They usually crucified people on trees. They did crucify people on crosses in the Roman Empire. And even if there was a cross, it weighs about 450 pounds. You can't carry it. What you would carry is the cross beam, which is about 40 to 50 pounds, which is doable. But now when you look at Luke 24... Luke 24, in verse 9. You can understand it a little better. And returning from the tomb, they reported all these things to the 11 and all the rest. This is when Miriam of Magdalene finds out he's alive. And they were Miriam Magdalene, Joanna, and Miriam, mother of Yaakov, and the rest with them who told these things to the apostles. And their words seemed like foolishness to them, and they did not believe them. But rising up, Peter ran to the tomb, and stooping down, he saw the linen lying alone. And he went away wondering to himself at what had happened. And behold, two of them were going on the same day, and that's when he sees talked about that already. But he went away wondering to himself what had happened. So when you see, when he appears to them, and it says, but some doubted, you'd say, how could they doubt? He's right before them. They're not doubting his resurrection. They're not doubting he's the Messiah. What they're doubting is, what is going on? What is the plan? What's happening from here? They didn't understand that the Messiah was not just coming as a second David to restore the glorious kingdom to Israel that once were. They didn't understand that at first the Messiah had to suffer and die for the sins of the people and pay the penalty for their sins and fulfill the first covenant so that there could be a new covenant. They didn't understand it. But then once Yeshua was resurrected and they got the Holy Spirit, their minds started to be open to this. So I am going to stop there for today. But like I said, really, you can't get into the early congregation without giving the background. You have to understand what's behind it. You have to understand the promises. You have to understand Israel's rejection of those promises, their diaspora, you know, the inter-testament period that comes, the Hellenization that was coming to Israel during the time of the Greek and the Romans, all of the different political things going on, the infrastructure fighting, and what exactly was the environment as Yeshua is making his birth and then his ministry, you know, in 26, 27 AD in the first century. And only by understanding that can you really understand what's coming on now. When we get into the next lesson on this, we'll get into now the New Testament congregation from Shavuot. You know, what are the changes now? We're going to see what is changing at this point and what's progressing, what's happening. We'll see what the early congregation believed. We'll see some of the things they were coming up with. We'll see what happens when 15 years later there's a big change and salvation is going to be open to another group of people. We'll see the Apostle Paul come into the picture and his role that he plays in this and so many other things. So that's for next time. We will stop here today. But Yahweh bless and Shabbat Shalom.